Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kawika Martin of Peace Action, who considers the consequences if the U.S. Congress rejects the recently signed international agreement limiting Iran's nuclear program. Four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who assesses the opportunities for promoting a progressive agenda in the 2016 election campaign. And Luz and Mark Colville, founders of New Haven's Amistad Catholic Worker House, who talk about their activism for social justice on their community's 20th anniversary. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human Rights Watch reports the South Sudan Army and affiliated militias carried out war crimes and sexual assaults on villagers during a recent offensive in rebel-held territory that forced tens of thousands of people to flee their homes. In a new report titled They Burned It All, the Human Rights Group documented 60 murders of civilian men, women, and children, as well as 63 cases of rape. South Sudan exploded into civil war in December 2013, 2 years after the new country declared independence from Sudan. Before the civil war, human rights monitors and the UN say that South Sudan's army, heavily financed by the United States, was guilty of multiple human rights abuses. Thus far, over 50,000 people have been killed and 2.2 million have been forced to flee their homes. Francois Conradi, a political analyst with the South African consultancy NKC Independent Economists, told the Wall Street Journal, "These horrific crimes against civilians mean that even if there is a political settlement, ethnic violence will persist as memories of atrocities linger." The Black Lives Matter movement confronting police violence has gained a foothold in Europe. In mid-May, hundreds of activists in Paris protested the acquittal of two police officers who in 2005 failed to prevent the electrocution of two youths, one black and one of Arab descent, after they ran into an off-limits electric power facility. In London, Black Lives Matter activists carried signs with the name of Julian Cole, a 21-year-old Briton who remains in a vegetative state after suffering a spinal injury during a 2013 confrontation with police. According to the news magazine In These Times, the Black Lives Matter protest movement has spurred global solidarity actions in cities from Sao Paulo to New Delhi. But street actions in Western Europe have been the most sustained due to charges that police commonly engage in racial profiling of growing immigrant populations. Today, blacks in Paris are 6 times more likely to be stopped by police than whites. In Britain, no police officers who have killed civilians in the line of duty have ever gone to prison. A group called Neighbors for Overnight Oversight has recently been publicizing horror stories about Airbnb, the short-term rental and web portal for travelers that has taken business away from traditional hotels and inns. Yet Neighbors for Oversight is not a grassroots effort, but a creation of the American Hotel and Lodging Association, the trade organization for hotel chains like Hilton and Marriott. The lodging industry is now working to pass new laws that would require Airbnb hosts to pay the same taxes that hotels and inns do. According to the Center for Public Integrity, 60 bills have been filed in state legislatures this year to regulate Airbnb and similar rental websites. Short-stay services are generally not required to pay occupancy taxes or follow sanitary codes that apply to hotels and inns. Joining the fight against Airbnb, the hotel industry has hired lobbyists in 42 states and donated over $11 million to state-level candidates in 2014. In response, Airbnb has hired lobbyists in 4 states, including California and Massachusetts. New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who has received contributions from the hotel industry, released a report in 2014 charging that 72% of Airbnb listings are functioning like illegal hotels. He said that New York's regulatory efforts were focused on ensuring that as online marketplaces revolutionize the way we live, laws designed to promote safety and quality of life are not forsaken under the pretext of innovation. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The battle in Congress over the future of the nuclear accord signed by Iran, the U.S., France, Britain, Russia, China, and Germany on July 14th is heating up. The agreement designed to limit Iran's nuclear capabilities to peaceful civilian purposes in exchange for the lifting of economic sanctions has drawn sharp criticism from Republican members of Congress, GOP presidential candidates, Israel and Saudi Arabia, among others. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has labeled the Iran nuclear deal as a historic mistake, has stated his intention to lobby Congress to reject the deal. Several powerful pro-Israel groups in the U.S. have announced the launch of a public relations ad campaign to persuade lawmakers to oppose the agreement. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, has created a standalone group, Citizens for a Nuclear-Free Iran, that will spend $20 to $40 million to convince legislators to support a resolution of disapproval in sufficient numbers to override a promised presidential veto. Of all the statements made in opposition to the Iran nuclear agreement coming from the 16 announced Republican presidential candidates, the harshest by far was delivered by former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. In a July 25th interview, Huckabee said of Obama, quote, "This president's foreign policy is the most feckless in American history. It is so naive that he would trust the Iranians. By doing so, he will take the Israelis and march them to the door of the oven," a direct reference to the World War II Holocaust, where the Nazis systematically murdered over 6 million Jews. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kawika Martin, political and communications director with the group Peace Action, who talks about the role of the U.S. peace movement in mobilizing support for the Iran nuclear accord and the consequences if Congress should succeed in derailing the agreement.
It's very difficult to tell exactly what happened if Congress votes to disapprove the deal. And it's more than just saying, oh, I disapprove the deal. The actual legislation, what would it do? It would block the administration the ability to remove the sanctions that is part of the international agreement that we've made with Iran. And, you know, it's just not the U.S. and Iran, it's the P5 plus one. So it's the whole U.N. Security Council plus Iran and plus Germany that have made this agreement. And so Congress could stop the U.S. from fulfilling its part. That would probably collapse the agreement. That would mean that Iran, we've frozen its nuclear program now and actually taken it a few steps back as we've been doing the negotiations. So if it were to fall apart, that means now Iran would move immediately closer to the ability, if it were to so decide, to make enough fissile material for one crude nuclear weapon. It would move it from what is probably now like 3 months, and this agreement would actually move it to a year. If it were to collapse, it might be now in like the weeks kind of a zone. Now, that might not push the Obama administration to take some sort of military intervention, although they might feel pressure to do so if there was some sort of intelligence that Iran is moving towards a nuclear weapon, but it may push Israel to do so. You know, experts are saying that any kind of military intervention is probably only going to push Iran's nuclear program back 2 or 3 years. It would probably force them to make a decision to move towards a nuclear weapon, even though they haven't made that decision at this point, and could, you know, start a whole war in the Mideast. You know, just as a comparison, you know, we did have this war in Iraq. We all know how much that cost, huge amounts of money, life and treasure. Iran is 3 times the population, 4 times the size. They've been spending billions of dollars more on this military compared to Iraq. It's a whole different ballgame, and we're talking costs that it's very difficult to calculate, and we're known that it's not going to work. So this is not a very good option, and there is really no other options besides this deal. So this deal is the way to move forward, and it's important that we get Congress to vote for it.
Paul, what is your group's strategy and other coalition partners' strategy going forward to convince those senators and representatives in Congress who may be on the fence to back this Iran nuclear accord? How much resources do you have to wage this battle over the next less than 60 days now when Congress has time to review the agreement?
Well, our yearly budget for all of our Peace Action affiliates across the country is some $4 or $5 million. The opposition is looking at spending $20 to $40 million on TV advertisement alone. So we, Peace Action, has nowhere near the budget to match the media spending that this opposition is going to happen. This is just a basic advocacy strategy over the next couple months, and that is getting as many of the experts on the issue. There's just tons and tons of not only diplomats, foreign policy experts, and nuclear weapons experts who support this deal. There have been letters of over hundreds of these type of people who have signed to support the deal. Getting those type of people to have discussions with congressional staff and members of Congress, and getting constituents to make phone calls, visits, letters, visiting members at their town halls over the summer, that type of thing. And that's what we'll be doing over the next couple months.
And Paul, what in your mind is the importance of this debate and its outcome here in the U.S. Congress? What's at stake?
This deal that to show that diplomacy can work. I mean, here during the Bush administration, you had actual Vice President Cheney pushing President Bush to use military intervention on Iran. That was even before it was as far as along with the centrifuge program. We've moved to that, to an administration that took a number of years, and it did. And this diplomacy did start actually under the Bush administration with Undersecretary Nick Burns, did start to reach out to Iran. So to show that here an international community can figure out this big problem, take 2 years to debate and negotiate and do the hard work, get a deal, and if it were to be scuttled, I mean, that is going to make us look bad in the international community, make it much more difficult to have good agreements in the future, perhaps push Iran in the wrong direction. But if it isn't scuttled and it moves forward, not only do we have an Iran that will be further away than a nuclear weapon than it is today, but we might be able to reach out to Iran on some of the other issues that we're concerned on, such as human rights in Iran, such as funding terrorism. And we're already secretly working with Iran on the ISIS issue. We could even work with them more on such issues as this. So it's probably one of the biggest foreign policy issues that we've faced over the last several years. And there's a lot at stake here, and Congress really needs to support this deal.
That was Paul Kawika-Martin, Political and Communications Director with the group Peace Action. For more views on the Iran nuclear agreement and the fight ahead in Congress, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Establishment political consultants and corporate media pundits have seen their conventional wisdom analysis of the 2016 presidential campaign upended by the surprise appeal of Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and real estate billionaire Donald Trump. Sanders, a self-described democratic socialist who passionately rails against growing economic inequality and challenges corporate power, has drawn unexpected enthusiasm to his campaign. Thus far, Sanders has drawn the largest crowds to his rallies of any candidate, Democrat or Republican. Reflecting his growing grassroots popularity, the independent Vermont senator has raised more than $15 million, made up mostly of contributions under $200. Meanwhile, the candidate that most commentators expect to win the Democratic nomination, former First Lady and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, has veered away from the centrist rhetoric of her failed 2008 campaign and adopted many of the same progressive positions as Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. In recent months, Clinton has forcefully talked about the need to reform the U.S. criminal justice system, gone further than President Obama in supporting policies that would shield undocumented immigrants from deportation, and discussed the need to impose new regulations on Wall Street. On the Republican side, billionaire real estate tycoon and reality TV star Donald Trump has shot to the top of many primary polls by launching ugly attacks against Mexican immigrants as murderers and rapists as he viciously insults his 15 fellow Republican candidates. The GOP establishment seems frightened about Trump's popularity, and what many observers maintain is a culture of hate and fear cultivated within the party over recent decades. Your reporter spoke with citizen activist, author, and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who assesses the opportunities for promoting a progressive agenda in the 2016 election campaign.
Starting with Bernie Sanders, he is drawing large crowds. I drew large crowds. That's only the first step, and often it's seen by a candidate as the last step. We filled Madison Square Garden with almost 20,000 people. 1,500 of them walked across the street and registered to vote. The rest just went back home. There is no innovation in how do you energize a large audience that is clapping and shouting rah-rah to your speech the day after and the day after that. He risks giving the same speech without localizing it and regionalizing it depending on where he is. And he's got to have people in those large audiences who basically start signing people up. They don't even get their names. He had 10,000 in front of the state legislature in Madison, Wisconsin. Where are their names? You got to pass the bucket to raise money. You've got to get them to pledge time. Candidates have to have hour raisers, time raisers, not just money raisers. Otherwise, we're just spinning our wheels with the same amateur progressive campaigns that have been going on for over 125 years. You know, I've seen it all before, and I've told Jill Stein, I said, Jill, you know, if you run as the Green Party presidential nominee, it's going to be the same old, same old. You're going to be blocked from the debates. You're not going to be able to raise much money. You'll get modest audiences here and there, and they'll all drift away and say, wasn't that great? Jill Stein talking about full Medicare for all, an MD graduate from Harvard Law School. That's the kind of political leader we want. But nothing happens. Now, the one thing that has changed is that Bernie's already raised over $15 million, Bernie Sanders, which means he's on track to raise well over $50 million, which means if he knows how to spend it, to get a multiplier effect out of the crowds that he's gathering and attracting, he can be a very significant force. But I don't see his advisors being that innovative, and I think there's a certain satiety among progressives. Wow, you know, 12,000 people in Phoenix, you know, and they, instead of being the beginning of the rumble, it's, oh, look, we did 12,000 in Phoenix. Let's go to Sacramento and see if we can increase it.
What are the prospects that Bernie Sanders or any other progressive candidate can use their time barnstorming the country for votes in an election? Can that be translated into building a political movement apart from the campaign, a movement that will outlive the campaign and, you know, hold Congress and the president to account for what they said when they were running for office?
Yes, I think if Bernie Sanders runs with the people, that means you go through Tennessee and Kentucky and you've got progressive groups trying to do something. You connect with them. If you're just going to give your national criticize Wall Street, criticize corruption, criticize consumer abuse, environment, you're not going to do that. You have to connect with the local groups, give them visibility. So when you have those big crowds, you put them on the stage. You have them say a few words. You have sign-up sheets for them. So when you leave town, they got more people. And now we tried to do that. The problem is that we had to spend all our resources and time just to get on ballots because we were an independent or third-party candidate. Bernie Sanders doesn't have to do that. He's going to be on the ballot automatically because he's registering as a Democrat. So he's got a lot of freedom now to connect with local groups, local movements who are starved for media, starved for new members, new energies. And when he sweeps through town, he's got to leave behind people who connect with all of these groups. Then you've got a movement. Otherwise, all you have is a speech that gets a lot of rah-rahs. So the question is whether he's got good advisors who know how to organize, who know how to avoid overexhausting him with too many events, and who know how to leave organizers behind to pick up on the enthusiasm and focus it when Bernie's off to the next campaign stop.
That was citizen activist, democracy advocate, and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, whose newest book is titled Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. Find more analysis on the 2016 presidential campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Catholic worker movement in the U.S., founded by Dorothy Day and Peter Morin in 1933, believes in responding to the material and spiritual needs of the poor by offering food, shelter, and prayer, but also by confronting the structural, economic, and political injustices in America that make poverty and violence possible. There are more than 200 Catholic worker communities that provide social services in cities across the U.S. Luz and Mark Colville founded the New Haven, Connecticut Amistad Catholic Worker House in 1994, in one of the city's poorest and most dangerous neighborhoods. There they raised 4 children, the youngest of whom is now 11. Over the years, the couple got to know their neighbors and took part in local and regional protests against war, homelessness, police violence, among other issues. Mark, who's been arrested many times in civil disobedience actions, was among the hundreds arrested during peaceful protests at the 2004 Republican National Convention in New York City. Police conduct there was so egregious that those arrested won a civil settlement 10 years later. With the $14,000 won in the lawsuit, the Colvilles decided to throw a big party at New Haven's Premier Park to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Amistad Catholic Worker House founding. Hundreds of people from the local community attended the afternoon beach party and an evening dinner dance. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with both Luz and Mark Colville and asked them to share a bit of history of their social activism and priorities.
Even though we have a roof that's starting to leak and needs to be replaced, we felt that for various reasons that it was important that we seize this moment to celebrate. Celebrate victories, celebrate the movement, celebrate the struggle that all of us are involved in. And so we decided that we'd use a good chunk of this money to throw a party for the 20th anniversary of the Amistad Catholic Worker. And so that's what we did.
One thing I remember as a reporter, you lived, especially years ago, lived in a pretty dangerous neighborhood. And right next door, there were people dealing drugs. And I remember you put up a sign that said, please get help and, you know, don't sell drugs. And right around that time, you got a bullet through one of your rooms, which happened to be the room where your infant son was sleeping. Then you organized this big march that went around the neighborhood in the evening and, you know, just made the point that you weren't going to tolerate that, that it wasn't good for the neighborhood, wasn't good for you. So that was one of my highlights. And then the drug dealing next door ceased, is that right?
Oh, yes. So it was Echo Elm City Congregations Organized. And all their dues-paying members and lay organizations got their people out there. And we had a candlelight vigil in our neighborhood calling out the drug dealers saying that we will not stand for this violence in our neighborhood. The drug dealers were out there, present, and they were all laughing at the beginning because it was only a couple of candles trickling in. And then all of a sudden you see this flood of candles coming through, hundreds coming through the corner of Morris Street. And it was just amazing. And Mark called out the drug dealers by name saying that this will not happen in this neighborhood. We have kids that we're raising, other neighbors are raising their kids, and it's time for it to stop. And pretty much people took notice that now it's no longer hidden in the darkness, and everyone started to feel confident that this is my neighborhood. And that's what it was all about. It's about empowering our neighbors to be able to say, I have a right to be safe. So we weren't, you know, instigating a problem here. We were just trying to help people see that everyone has a right to live in their own neighborhood as safe as possible.
So my understanding of how the Catholic Worker operates is that, you know, there's sort of two tracks. One is meeting people's everyday needs by providing food and clothing and other things that, you know, people can come and get once a week, basically. And the food is every day or Monday through Friday. But then there's also kind of the speaking truth to power. And I know that Mark has been arrested so many times, we can't even, you probably can't keep track. But just talk about that a little bit, Mark, some of the things you've done over the years. And you've served some serious jail time as part of that.
Well, first of all, we have an open door for meals, okay? And that's where everything starts. Everything that we get involved in, both individually and as a community, it all starts at the table, you know, what we call a common table, and everybody's invited to come and break bread together. And we use that moment, we use those meals as a way of, first of all, of people getting to know each other, and then secondly, people learning how to share their burdens with each other and to carry, you know, to carry the other person's burdens. And so when we get involved in social issues, it all is an outgrowth of the relationships that are nurtured in the breaking of bread, okay? So, you know, when we, in the Catholic worker movement, there's a very rich history and tradition of anti-war action, nonviolent action against war and the various other forms of violence against the poor. And so small groups of us have often been involved in acts of resistance against violence and injustice and poverty and the impoverishment of people. You know, as a somebody trying to be a Christian, it's, I feel a strong imperative to really look at the law and how the law justifies immorality and crimes against humanity, and then to stand on the other side of that law. And so we've been involved in various kinds of movements over the years at the Amistad House, from the Plowshares movement to the anti-torture movement, and of course resisting all of the numerous invasions that our country has been involved in, our military has been involved in since 1994 when we first organized.
So just going forward for the next 20 years, Luce, what do you see as kind of your job, or what's your vision of the Catholic work of the Amistad in the Hill neighborhood in the city of New Haven?
I think what's really great about the Amistad Catholic Worker is that we sort of move with the flow and sort of respond to people in crisis. So there is no hidden agenda. There is no planned agenda. We sort of have to just move forward and live day to day. I'm not home all the time. I do work outside of the household to supplement the income of our community to make sure the bills are paid in order for our house to stay open for people to come in to have their needs met. But I'm there for the long haul.
That was Luz and Mark Colville, founders of New Haven's Amistad Catholic Worker House. Learn more about the Catholic worker movement in the U.S. and New Haven by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.